Hello and welcome to the Law and Guidance podcast, where we talk about the law and the practice of law, and indeed the practicalities of some of the laws that we use here in the UK and internationally. And I'm so thrilled because I've got the wonderful Felicity Gerry, Queen's Counsel, joining me today to talk about joint enterprise, amongst various other topics and how it links. Welcome, Felicity.
Hi, Sally. Thank you for having me.
Now, Felicity, I know people would have heard you on my other podcast, Talking Law Before, which is about the leaders in law and their leading cases. But I'd like you just to introduce yourself to us, please, because you're an international counsel, but you live in Australia, but you appear in England a lot, but you are originally English. Can you just say who you are?
Yes, I'm actually Professor Felicity Gerry, Queen's Counsel, but I'm in Chambers in London, Libertas Chambers in London, and Crockett Chambers in Melbourne, and I'm also on the lists at the International Criminal Court and the Kosovo Specialist Chambers. So I've built myself an international practice in criminal law, international criminal law, and sort of related areas such as illegal logging in climate change law or modern slavery, those sort of associated criminal conduct, including commercial crime and fraud. I'm also Professor of Legal Practice at Deakin University in Melbourne, and I'm an honorary professor at the University of Salford. So I engage in research projects as well on law reform, and again, largely criminal law and some associated aspects, including administrative law and judicial review. So challenging cases is what I tend to take. That seems to describe me best.
Yes. Yes, and a large brain, if I may say so. So let's start with some of them, because I've used a lot of the cases you've appeared in myself in my own practice, as of many practitioners listening. But the issue of joint enterprise generally, and maybe if we focus rather than on sort of public disorder offences and a phrase and public orders, but on homicide, so death, what is joint enterprise and how has it been used in homicide cases?
Okay, so look, thank you for the compliment on big brain. I tend to call myself a hard worker because this area of law needs a lot of expertise and a lot of research. And it's something that I've done for decades now, is just try and make myself an expert in what we do. And joint enterprise really was a label that grew up in England and Wales for what is really the law of complicity. When is someone complicit in someone else's crime? So you might have a principal offender, that's the stabber or the shooter, and then you might have accessories, people who are helping that stabber or shooter in some way, or encouraging them or procuring them to do it, which is also an area of law that isn't particularly well understood, and we can talk about in more detail in the context of modern slavery, for example. So all these ways in which the law has tried to criminalise people who are not the primary offender, if you like. And we can think of serious examples like commanders, military commanders in international war crimes, as well as someone who hides the gun for a shooter or something like that. There's many and various ways in which you can be complicit in a crime. What I think is really important to think about is when someone is not complicit in a crime, and when we're trying to overstretch the criminal law to criminalise people who actually have very little or nothing to do with the principal's crime. So if we think about it as the law of complicity, and here I like to focus on homicide, where it causes the most injustices, in my opinion.
Yes.
And in order to understand it properly, you have to know a little bit about the history. So forgive me, I'm not going to give you a law lecture, but a little bit of history that hundreds and hundreds of years ago, we tried to work this out. And there are some leading authorities from 1500s onwards, really. You can look back at legal history and find cases in which judges have tried to grapple with when are people complicit or not in a crime. And we developed the law to ensure that we didn't make everybody complicit, anybody who's there taking risks or being with risky friends, we only criminalise those people who intended to join in. So intended to assist or encourage, we used to use the language of aid, abet, counsel and procure, intended to somehow contribute to that crime or intended to be in control of that crime in some way. And we then had other modes of liability. So we developed something called felony murder. So if you embark on a felony, say a robbery or a burglary, and a death occurs in the course of that felony, then that was labelled felony murder. So people would be liable for a death that occurred in the felony that they took part in. And I can give you some examples of some injustices that have occurred in that circumstance. But to understand the history, the way in which we defined that law was to say, well, if you embark on a felony and the consequence of someone dying was foreseeable, a foreseeable consequence, objectively foreseeable consequence, then you were guilty of felony murder. Now, in England and Wales, we abolished felony murder in 1957. Then there was an issue around something called constructed murder, which I won't trouble you with today. And we abolished that in 1967. So the idea that you would be convicted of murder for something that was foreseeable was abolished in England and Wales, because obviously it was over-criminalising. People who'd engaged in a burglary were being convicted of murder. And we can see those injustices, particularly for Black people and particularly in America on death row. So I'll talk about that in a little while. But, you know, a really good thing to do was confine liability to those who intend to join in and don't have this sort of constructed liability around felony murder. Unfortunately, what the English courts then did was grapple with this by saying, well, look, we've got to make something up. And first of all, in the modern history of things, in 1984, a judge in the Privy Council created something that was later to be called parasitic accessorial liability, which I'm going to use PAL for short, which is what we really call joint enterprise now. And he sort of corrupted two words and said, if you foresee or contemplate something, then you authorize it, which is a semantic nonsense, as I later said in the UK Supreme Court. If you contemplate something, it doesn't mean you authorize it. So it was a mistake, if you like, in the Privy Council that was then leapt on by English judges, and you can trace the history for those interested in the history. And we came to a case called Powell and English. So I'm not going to give you all the cases, but this is the bit that matters. In Powell and English, the House of Lords said, oh, we're going to adopt this. We're going to have this thing called joint enterprise or parasitic accessorial liability. Let's give it a try, even though we know it's illogical. And the test they created was subjective, not objective. So it's different in that sense from felony murder. But it was, if you foresee the possibility that someone you're with is going to commit that further crime, then you're guilty. So if you embark on crime A, instead of foreseeable probabilities, effectively objective probabilities in felony murder, we suddenly had foresight of possibilities, which was a shocking thing for the House of Lords to do, as it then was. And indeed, to say that it was illogical and still do it, let's give it a try, because we've got to try and convict these people, it's a shocking read. And that really led the way to cases where all appeals were lost, because you can foresee pretty much anything.
Yeah.
We also lost manslaughter, because once you can foresee the possibility of something, it could be anything. So manslaughter wasn't really a viable alternative. So pretty much everybody coming before the courts for an allegation of being complicit in a murder was convicted. So there's about 30 years of people being convicted on the wrong law in England and Wales, and on a law that was adopted for a totally flawed policy that has particularly affected youth, Black youth. And the prisons have at least 1,000 people still in them whose juries were wrongly directed on this error of law, that instead of looking for the people who intend to join in some way, those who foresaw the possibility that someone they're with might do something all ended up in prison for one of the highest possible offences, all serving life sentences for murder. So it was a huge injustice that lasted for decades, which is a really shocking piece of English legal history.
Mm. Well, it is, but it has proved useful, hasn't it, for those of us who prosecute and defend, as a useful tool in cases where one couldn't find the principal offender. And so using the intended consequences or foreseeable consequences, as you put it, was an easier way to prove cases. And I know there's been a big campaign, there's been a documentary, even on Twitter, I think there's a handle called Against JE. So I can see from the flip side why that might have been or appear to have been an attractive way at that time, albeit it was wrong and it was overturned by Jokey. I was just going to say, what do you think about
it? Only useful for unprofessional, very privileged people. When you think about it, it's totally unprincipled. There's 500 years of law that it was ignoring. There was no law behind it. They said it was a policy. Courts are meant to be about law, not policy. Yeah. It was totally, to me, seems much more like politics than policy. And it has no safe foundation. If you think about it, if you're a mother and you foresee the possibility that your son goes outside the door to have a fight at some point on a Friday night, does that make you criminally responsible for what your son does? No, of course not. Yeah. So it's really used by a privileged profession, our profession, to convict people who were not criminally responsible. And I find that unforgivable. And certainly it was the motivation behind taking the appeal that you've just mentioned. So I don't think we should call it useful. I think we should call it unprincipled, unprofessional, and politically motivated, and a total failure of the criminal justice system. And the push for prosecutors to use it again is frankly diabolical.
Yes. Well, let's talk a bit then about restoring the correct law, if you like, and sort of reviving manslaughter, and talk about Jogi and Lewis, which is another case that you were in. Can you tell us a little bit about both of those cases?
Yeah, look, I could do a whole podcast on one case. So this is a bit of a gallop, an opinionated gallop, as you've heard. You know what I'm like. But Jogi was, you know, it was a stabbing in a house in Leicester that could have been not obviously for the victim or the victim's family or for Mr. Jogi, who was wrongly accused of being complicit in that murder. But it was actually quite an ordinary story. Sadly, stabbings happen all the time. The question was whether or not he was complicit in what someone else did inside a house. And the evidence against him was he shouted, "Come on." And it's either "come on, let's have a fight," or "come on, let's go." And he was texting someone to get a lift at the time. So there was a tribal issue on whether he committed a crime at all, whether murder or manslaughter. But by the time we got to his case, and I was the junior defending, this direction on foresight of possibilities was meant to be used in crime A, crime B type cases. So you embark on a crime, robbery or burglary, and you foresee the possibility that someone else would commit this further crime, and then you'd be equally responsible, which of itself was you know my views about it. But by this time, through a case called Rook, the first part had gone. You didn't even have to embark on a crime A. It was if you foresaw the possibility, you were guilty. And that's how the jury were directed in Mr. Jogi's trial. It was, they went back for something, and if he foresaw the possibility that the co-defendant would commit murder, he was equally guilty, which was really a total nonsense. And we argued at the close of the prosecution case, we argued in the Court of Appeal. My silk went off to chair the Jersey inquiry into child abuse. I took silk. And long story short, I took the appeal to the UK Supreme Court on two grounds of appeal that are not actually in the judgment and I think should be. First was, could we change it from possibility to probability? That would be, of course, bringing back a form of felony murder, but at least it would make juries stop and think before convicting people on the periphery. And if you can't manipulate the law like that, and bearing in mind we're up against a case, Powell and English, where the law had been manipulated. So if you're not going to manipulate it to probability rather than possibility, you've got to recognise that Parliament abolished this constructed form of liability. So you've got it completely wrong, and you've got to go back to the proper law of intention. So the second ground of appeal was joint enterprise over-criminalises secondary parties. So what we said was, you've just got to get rid of this parasitic accessorial liability because it's a total nonsense. Here's the correct law. You must restore it. And that's what they did. So they expunged PAL, got rid of it, recognised that it was an error of law, and that's their language, not mine, restored the correct law, said you've got to prove that principals or accessories intend the crime or intend to assist or encourage that crime. And the test is knowledge of the essential facts, acts that demonstrate an intention to assist or encourage in Jogi, and of course that it's not too remote. And we'll come to overwhelming supervening acts later in this podcast. But they restore the correct law. And of course, that allows us to revive manslaughter. So you can give juries alternatives. They don't have to convict on possibilities. And that means it doesn't matter if you can't show who the principal is. I think one of the major errors that everybody made was thinking, well, if you can't say who the principal offender was, you can't say who the accessories were. But it doesn't work like that at all. You've simply got to show that you know the essential facts that this crime's going to happen. You intend to insist or encourage that. And it's not too remote. So you intend to insist or encourage that crime. It doesn't matter who's physically doing it. It is entirely possible under the correct law to prosecute people when you don't know exactly who did the stabbing or who did the shooting, but you know that those people were assisting or encouraging that crime. So you don't necessarily have to share exactly the same intention or with the principal offender, but you do have to have the intention to either commit the crime or be an accessory to that crime. And in a group scenario, there's no difference really in the type of evidence that you put before the court. And I think that the main reason that prosecutors thought it was useful was because they didn't have to do any work and they didn't have to be precise. And now we have a proper legal structure where prosecutors have to say what their case is in fact and law. Sadly, it's taking a very long time for prosecutors to do their job properly. And I've had so many cases since Jogi where the law has still been misunderstood that I feel like a bit of a professor in court. And Lewis is one of those. You know, I said to the prosecutor at the beginning of the case, well, what's your case? How do you put your case on murder? Because you couldn't prove whether the crime was committed by the defendants or whether actually it was an accident. So how were they going to rebut the realistic possibility that this was an accident? It was a man who burned to death, and they're around the terrible charred remains of his body, there was a cigarette lighter right by his head. So you couldn't exclude the possibility of accident, and therefore there was a reasonable doubt. And the judge agreed, stopped the case at the close of prosecution case, so acceded to a submission of no case to answer. The prosecution put their case on the basis that everybody was a principal offender, which plainly they weren't. And it went to the Court of Appeal on an appeal against a terminating ruling. The prosecution still thought that they didn't have to identify anyone as responsible for the crime. But what you have to do is prove that there was a crime. It doesn't matter who's responsible for it, but was there a crime, and can you show that that person was involved? And the Court of Appeal agreed. The prosecution put their case on joint principalship. That couldn't be proved, and therefore the not guilty verdict stood. But the important part is that the prosecution had put the cases, or everybody's a joint principal, instead of saying, well, look, they're either principals or accessories, but here's the evidence of the crime. And the real problem in Lewis was there was no evidence that this wasn't a terrible accident. So it's just a good example of how prosecutors were still trying to push the envelope to make it easier to prosecute people who you can't prove have actually done anything wrong. Which is, it's all a bit shocking, really.
Now we talked about
that's a couple of cases that I've done in this context.
Yes, no, they're really interesting. Now, I know those cases because I've used them myself, and they are quite interesting. And you're right, I didn't remember the points that are not in the judgment about possibility or probability, which are really quite interesting points, but probably another subject, another topic.
Yeah, I can talk to you about manslaughter all day long, but not today.
Yes, yeah. But well, I'd just like to move on to my next question, if I may, then, because we've talked about the UK, but I want to see if we can talk about what's happening internationally. What's been the effect of Jogi in Australia, for example, Hong Kong, and also in the US, because I noticed Annalise Keating has appeared there and on a couple of cases.
Well, I love Annalise Keating because she's the character in How to Get Away with Murder in the series, played by Viola Davis. And yeah, she takes all the cases that you really want to take. You know, she goes to the Supreme Court fighting for black people in the criminal justice system. She takes a case to sue the whole system for the treatment of black people against a background of all sorts of murder and mayhem. But of course, she's a defense lawyer and a professor of legal practice, same as me. So I'm not surrounded by murder and mayhem, but I sort of love what they've tried to do with the program. And, you know, it's close to my heart. But look, as always,
let's start with Australia then.
Look, as always, I get the opportunity to tell my stories to you, which is great. And all I'm really trying to do is get your listeners to think about it. But after Jogi, I had a case in Australia. South Australia still runs on the common law, so not the whole of Australia does. And I had a homicide appeal there where I said, look, your law's wrong as well. Case called McAuliffe is the same as Powell and English. You've created this parasitic extension. You need to get rid of it too. Plus, the jury were wrongly directed in this case, which was called Spilios. And I lost in the Court of Appeal. They said, well, that is the law, so we can't change it. I tried to go to the Australian High Court, which is their Court of Final Appeal. And I said, look, you know, you need to hear my appeal. I want to be consolidated with a case called Miller, Presley and Smith so that we can all discuss the getting rid of parasitic accessorial liability in Australia, which is known as extended common purpose there. And the High Court of Australia said, no, you're not going to be consolidated. They then heard the case of Miller, Presley and Smith, in which they said, well, it's not really been argued properly. And this is a case about intoxication anyway. So we'll bounce that back to the Court of Appeal to be decided on the intoxication issue. So we're not going to consider getting rid of extended common purpose. And then after that, they refused my application for special leave. So I must say, it did look as though it was a deliberate decision to keep it when they had the opportunity to decide otherwise. So I was sorely disappointed with the High Court of Australia that they didn't even take the opportunity to consider getting rid of parasitic accessorial liability properly. And of course, there are real problems in Australia for over-criminalisation, particularly where I lived for a while in the Northern Territory, where the numbers of Aboriginal people in custody are just appalling. So I did think it was an opportunity missed in Australia. I then tootled off to Hong Kong to do the same thing in Hong Kong. And I had a case called Chan Kam Shing. And I led the wonderful Margaret Eng, who, of course, was recently in the public eye for her protesting in leading the protests in Hong Kong. Read about her case online. So I led Margaret. We went to the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong and they did something really weird. They said, well, we're going to keep it, but we're going to keep it for spontaneous violence. We're going to have an extension for those people who engage in spontaneous violence. So they sort of made up their own version, which is, of course, now being used against the Hong Kong protesters, which I find equally diabolical, really, or worse still. And I've yet to write it all up, but I certainly spoke to a lot of people while Margaret's case was going on, and I'm following what's going on in Hong Kong and hope to have another go at it in expunging parasitic accessorial liability in Hong Kong, because, you know, there's your mum point again, you know, the mum who watches her children go out to protest an unjust law in Hong Kong. If there's expansive liability, then PAL is going to be used cruelly, I think, in those circumstances. So I want an opportunity to go back in Hong Kong and to go back up in Australia. So it's very much an issue that needs to be resolved elsewhere.
Yes, well, I'm sure that the right cases will enable you to take the point. But what about the ICC, which I'm always really interested in because of domestic prosecutions for war crimes there? How is the joint enterprise principle post Jogi being used there for on commanders and so on?
Yeah, look, in the ICC, it's really interesting because thinking about how complicity works, you might have people on the ground committing terrible offences. So let's think about felony murder that still exists in America. So in felony murder, I will come to the ICC, I promise, but it just helps you to think about it. In felony murder, two people embark on a store robbery, for example. There are cases such as this, and it pops up in the TV show we've talked about. They commit a robbery of a convenience store. They run from the scene. One of them is shot by a police officer. The other one then goes to prison for murder because their friend is shot by the police officer, because it's a foreseeable consequence of the convenience store robbery that someone will be shot in America. And therefore, the robber serves time for the murder committed by the police officer. So the outcomes of these extensions of liability are really shocking when they're wrongly used. Totally shocking, and account for terrible injustices of young people being imprisoned for things that other people do that they're not complicit in. So that's one extreme. So you can see how extensions of liability can over-criminalise, particularly secondary parties. The other extreme is you might have a commander in a war situation or a civil war situation. So one example is Dominic Ongwen, who's just been convicted before the International Criminal Court, but there are others. Most criminal cases in the International Criminal Court concern a commander who's going to say, well, I'm not on the ground. I didn't pull the trigger. I wasn't there. There's a chain of command. People down the line are responsible, but not me. And what we want to do is have a system whereby we can show that the commander is responsible, is criminally responsible. And you can start to see how we might want to expand liability to include a commander. So the Rome Statute is very clear on this. It's about whether someone knew or should have known. So there is an extension for commanders where they should have known in the context of war crimes. But the ICC cases have sort of got themselves in a mess, and some of the other international criminal tribunals more so. The International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, ICTY, they had a form of parasitic accessorial liability that was really expansive, known as JCE3. So without going too much into all the law, you can start to see how we would want to convict commanders. But we're still grappling with how does that law work? And when what the International Criminal Court does is it says, well, let's look at customary international law. Let's have a look at how the law of complicity works in other countries. Let's have a look at Germany. They have a requirement to prove some level of control. Let's have a look at England and Wales.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on a minute. England and Wales have got themselves in a muddle. They've now sorted themselves out. And we've currently got an adoption of the language by one international criminal court judge of sufficient nexus. Is there a sufficient nexus or connection? And what they're really grappling with is causation or remoteness. If we say, well, that commander knew or should have known, can we still say that someone in their shoes would not have contemplated that happening? Or someone in their shoes would have contemplated that happening. And that's where foresight and contemplation comes in. It's a check on how many people you convict. So in England and Wales, in Jogi, the judges preserved what's called overwhelming supervening act. They didn't use that language. They didn't use the language of remoteness. They didn't use the language of causation, but it's exactly what they're talking about. It's about that, not so much that you knew, not so much that you intended to join in or to command, but it's about grasping that connection with the crime. With that knowledge, with those actions, are you connected to what happened on the ground? And with most proper commanders, you can see the connection down the train of command, and it doesn't stop you convicting people. And I think the test that they use in Jogi, putting yourself in the defendant's shoes, would you have contemplated that happening, is a really good test. And that doesn't exist yet in international criminal law. There's this sort of tension between civil law jurisdictions and common law jurisdictions as to whether you have to have an element of control or a nexus. So again, it's really interesting, because obviously all I want to do is go and sort out a way in which we can all understand how to use complicity carefully to convict commanders, but not to convict sometimes those people on the ground who are just there or just in the wrong place at the wrong time and have no intention of contributing. So we have to make sure that we're making correct decisions to prosecute, as well as principled decisions in law to convict those people who are truly criminally responsible and to acquit those who are not, or where there isn't sufficient evidence to convict. So that, I think, helps us to understand how complicity is moulded to fit particular circumstances and can go horribly wrong.
Yeah. Well, then, looking at that as an overview then, are there still ongoing problems in UK trials and appeals, or have they all sorted out now?
No, well, the terrible thing about Jogi, well, I suppose it was wonderful and terrible in equal measure, because wonderful in that it restored the correct common law, which requires knowledge of the essential facts, which is often missed, and I'll come to that in a moment, and the concept of remoteness through overwhelming supervening acts, and this requirement to prove that someone intended to be an accessory, which I think is great. But then they spent half the judgment saying, well, by the way, all of those of you who've been wrongly convicted, you all have to prove that you've been that you would not have been convicted under the correct law, and that we're going to create this test called the substantial injustice test that we normally apply to changes of law, but we're now going to apply to our own error of law, which I thought was appalling. You know, we made the mistake that you're going to pay for it, is what it looks like. That's what it looks like. You know, it's like I've labelled it recognising you've done something wrong, but refusing to say sorry. And having made a policy decision in Powell and English to make this policy decision that finality, not having any appeals, is more important than liberty, I find unfathomable, and such a shame in a judgment that really engaged in legal principle to then engage in this exercise of not releasing people whose juries were wrongly directed and not finding a way to sort out which cases should have been murder, which manslaughter and which not guilty, or which cases should go back for a retrial. What's wrong with that? I can't fathom why the Supreme Court sought to do that, other than perhaps they thought it would have more legitimacy if there wasn't fear of a bunch of murderers being released on the streets. And of course, these are not murderers at all. These are people wrongly convicted on the wrong law, of usually in situations where they haven't done very much at all. So the ongoing problem in the UK is that appeals are blocked. There's only really been one successful out of time appeal since. And of course, that was John Crilly, who went on to be marvellously one of the people who tackled the terrorist on London Bridge. So you can visibly see someone who has contributed to the community in a major way, and it allows people to understand that in prison are people who can contribute to society in a meaningful way and who have been wrongly convicted. So I think we've got a better idea of how miscarriages of justice work in joint enterprise, thanks to John Crilly. So appeals are a real issue. I think they're about, according to Jengba, who is the campaign group, and they're marching soon, I think there are about 1,000 people who are still serving. There'll be others that are out that were wrongly convicted. And that, it seems to me, is a terrible injustice. And this substantial injustice test that's being applied, really, and my words that I put in a submission to the all-party parliamentary group on miscarriages of justice that was adopted by them in their report, is that this also neuters the Criminal Cases Review Commission.
Yeah,
that they can't refer cases if they can't, if they have to apply this substantial injustice test. So I've got an ongoing appeal that I hope will sort it out. I'm not sure whether they'll be up for it, but I hope so. So at the moment, there's a serious problem with ongoing appeals that I think needs to be sorted out. And there are, of course, trials. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Sally, I'm rattling on. Go ahead.
No. I was just thinking, you know, appeals are one thing because, of course, as we all know, one has to have leave and, you know, there are less and less cases getting leave. But what about trials, the day-to-day trials that I do and other lawyers are conducting both here and around the world? What's happening there? You know, are there missing directions on knowledge or recognizing autism? You know, what are there? What's going on? Circumstantial evidence, is that being compatible with Jogi? What's going on in trials? Certainly ones that you've been involved in.
I'm absolutely 100% confident that Jogi fixed the legal problem that was a legal problem. And if you read the legal history that we started on, I defy anyone not to agree with me. There are other ways of fixing the problem. There are other suggestions, but that at least was intended to make people think very carefully about convicting people on the periphery, trying to confine liability to those truly criminally responsible. It was a very principled decision, and you can argue till you're blue in the face, well, we could have done it this way or we could have done it that way, and there are other ways of doing it that might be more helpful. But, you know, there's something about staying true to the legal principles that have been around for hundreds of years, and that this I think was a good one. But then it takes a long time to implement because, of course, prosecutors liked it easy. They liked to be able to convict people on this easy test. And I think prosecutors should be made to work hard to convict people of particularly murder, when it might not be murder, it might be manslaughter or nothing at all.
Yeah.
And it's been really interesting doing trials post-Jogi because, and just by way of example, you mentioned knowledge. Now, yeah. Jogi is very, very clear that it is a requirement that the person has knowledge of the essential facts. You can't intend something you don't know about. It's very simple. I actually think knowledge is an element of the offence. You can't really prove it without proving that they knew what was going on around them. Some argue that it's not an element, it's just intrinsic in intention. But nonetheless, it's in the decision. So it's something that judges have to think about at the close of the prosecution case. Can the prosecution prove that that person knew what the crime was that was being planned or was going to happen? What can they prove that knowledge? And that, therefore, if the judge takes the view that there is some evidence of knowledge and it's for the jury to decide, that word knowledge needs to be in the legal directions. Yeah. And I can tell you, in 5 of the last 6 trials, murder trials that I've done in England and Wales, every single time I've had to put that into the judge's draft directions. They've left out the word knowledge or the language of knowledge. So that's 5 out of 6 trials. That's a high percentage where the prosecution haven't suggested it. Prosecution have said, yep, we like that. And I've had to say, well, actually, you need to add knowledge. And everybody's agreed that that's the correct thing to do, but it's not been included in the original draft direction. So it got included because I was there. But in those trials, I can tell you, one silk said, oh, it all sounds a bit hard to me. Another one said, well, Miss Gerry will take this point, you know. And the barristers were not clear on how the law works, even silks, which I find remarkable. And the judges, great, they give you a draft, they want your input, they've got it in the compendium, they were thinking about it. I don't really criticize the judges for leaving it out because they're trying to work out how to deal with generalities in a compendium, but fitting it to the particular case. All of them agreed to put knowledge in. But how many trials are going by without that being done if I'm not in them? I hope not many, but I can tell you 5 out of 6 in the first draft, it was missed. Now, everybody may have got back to it without me, but that's my experience. Now, knowledge is really important as well, because if you can't intend something you don't know about, you need to know that the person knows there's a plan to rob, for example, before, or knows there's a plan to kill. And somebody with autism or other mental health or mental or cognitive disorders, of course, autism's not a mental health problem, but I'm just sort of unfortunately lumping people together here, and I apologize for that. But people with issues around neurodiversity or mental health issues, or who are victims of domestic violence that might affect their perceptions of what's going on around them, just by way of example, may not know. And unless the jury know that that person has those disorders or things affecting their knowledge of what's going on around them, then I don't think convictions are safe. And certainly I can tell you, in one case that I've done recently, the jury did not know that my client was autistic. And perhaps it's easier to talk about the case of Alex Henry, which was an appeal where his jury did not know he was autistic. There was fresh evidence available on appeal, so he asked for a retrial. Court of Appeal didn't accept the diagnosis, rejected the expert evidence, which has since been confirmed, and refused him leave to appeal. And even though there was no prosecution expert to dispute the expert in that appeal. So I don't entirely understand why there's a resistance to recognising that people have autism and other conditions that affect their knowledge. But that is a serious problem in a criminal trial if juries are not hearing that defendants are autistic. So you've got a problem with legal error and a problem with factual information. And there are other problems, but I can hear you want to ask me a question. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I also have an issue, because I conduct a lot of cases where actually the defendants have got autism and have got a variety of neurodiverse conditions. And that is an ongoing problem. And I wondered if you thought that it was perhaps verging on a policy decision rather than a legal decision, because it would give an escapism, a special characteristic perhaps, to defendants and thereby justify their conduct or offending behavior. I don't know, it's
a really good question, and I can see why you're asking it. I think we just have to be cautious at the moment that we have a system whereby we do deal with appeals on a case-by-case basis. And it takes a long time for those cases to get before the Court of Appeal, for the Court of Appeal to be able to say, yeah, actually, there's a problem here. So if not many cases have got to the Court of Appeal on this issue, then they've not had the chance to address the problem. And I'm a great believer in appeals being able to consider the jurisprudence around an issue. So I hope there's no policy. I appreciate it might affect large swathes of the population. I rather hope that my forthcoming appeal will allow us to think about these things, which probably means I can't give you a straight answer to your question. I think it is something we all need to think about. Is our criminal justice system working properly? Is this a question for the Court of Appeal or the UK Supreme Court or for Parliament? How is it working? And is it working fairly? I don't think so. That's my opinion. But I would like the opportunity to make the law work more clearly in cases of complicity for people with various neurodiverse and mental health issues. I think it is the biggest issue in our criminal justice at the moment. Now we have so much more knowledge on the science. You know, science tends to change the law, and that's what we're really seeking to do here, is once we understand the science, we probably have to reform the law.
Wow, gosh, I felt like we were talking about COVID then.
that too.
Yeah, having been talking about the science and the science. Felicity, what about, I was asking you about, you know, recent trials and continued errors in trials with standing Jogi in the UK and so on. But I wanted to ask you, and what I was wondering about, you know, the errors, so suppositions disguised as inferences, telephone evidence, guilt by association, especially in gang and music-related offences and music-related evidence. How's Jogi being used there? And what are the dangers of expansive liability and errors by lawyers and judges, which sometimes look like politics?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm very troubled by some of the methods that are currently used in the presentation of evidence. So, for example, in a case I'm aware of, a defendant was convicted of being involved in a murder solely on a pattern of telephone calls. And that, it seems to me, is a very dangerous way to look at circumstantial evidence. You've got no direct evidence, no witnesses, not accepting what that person's defense is. That person says, no, actually, I was phony for this reason, nothing to do with the murder. So that the prosecution get to tell a story on their version of some telephone evidence. And I find that very troubling indeed. And of course, the presentation of that evidence, here's a timeline of telephone calls, is then quite often presented in four different ways. So the presentation of it perhaps carries more weight than it should, because the jury are asked to look at pictures of patterns of telephone calls in four different ways. Here's a spider chart, here's a schedule of events, here's a schedule of telephone calls, here's a color-coded chart, and actually it's all the same evidence. I had a recent trial where sort of about 200 pages of telephone calls, maybe more. In fact, the relevant calls for my client could be reduced to a single page. And of course, we produced that and we gave it to the jury. And I was able to say in my closing address, you know, actually, this is all it is. And it's all after the event. So this is the real picture. But it does worry me that telephone evidence is being given more credence than it should be. And that we're convicting people of very serious crimes on technical information. And similarly with CCTV, you know, no sound, you look at a grainy image in the distance, the prosecution tell a story, the judge lets that go to the jury. And what story are the jury going to believe? And is that really compliant with the requirement for a jury to be sure? I think is seriously problematic. But more importantly, from my perspective, similarly to the other trials I told you about, in I think 4 out of 6 recent murder trials, the wording of Kilbourne, which is the old case on circumstantial evidence, taken together, it has to be able to rebut realistic possibilities. That's the language of Kilbourne. That last sentence, it not just that taken together, it can be as equally strong as direct evidence, which is what you hear daily in court. Kilbourne actually says it also has to rebut realistic possibilities. Now, there's one decision since Jogi called Jordan Bassett, in which the Court of Appeal quashed a conviction because the evidence was equally consistent with panic. So the people panicking. So the circumstantial evidence could not rebut the realistic possibility that the defendant was acting in panic rather than acting to further the crime. And that means that the Court of Appeal have recognised the importance of Kilbourne as a decision, and they refer to it. And they've recognised how circumstantial evidence works properly in a very recent case in 2020. But in all of the cases that I did in 2021, sorry, 4 out of 6 cases, I had to remind the judges again to add on that sentence. It must be able to rebut realistic possibilities. So have cases been going along without that sentence? Have juries been wrongly directed on circumstantial evidence? So they're presented with these timelines of phone calls, video images, and saying, well, circumstantial evidence can be just as strong as direct evidence. Off you go. instead of saying, well, actually what you've got to do is think about what a reasonable doubt is, what a realistic other possibility is. It shouldn't just turn on which barrister can give the best speech. It should mean that the juries are properly directed in law. And actually, judges should be looking at that at the close of the prosecution case. And if the prosecution case can't rebut the realistic possibility of panic, then judges should be stopping trials on that basis. And I have had one or two where the judge has ruled that there's no case to answer on murder and only left manslaughter to the jury. But you have to work pretty hard to get those. So I think there is a problem with the way in which circumstantial evidence is being dealt with in England and Wales. Well, and then if I take a deep breath on gangs and music evidence, I know you've asked me about that, but I'll let you go with your question first.
Well, just before I ask you about that, it is an interesting point you make, but just on the video and telephone evidence, circumstantial evidence, they're interesting points, aren't they? But isn't that the role of the jury to assess the grainy CCTV and work out what could be said and look at the timelines and see if the phone calls could
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying it's not admissible. I'm absolutely not saying you can't use phones and CCTV, and they're very useful tools for prosecutors. And I'm not saying that nobody is complicit in a crime, but there are ways in which you can assess evidence within a legal framework that allow you to sort out who is criminally responsible, who's joined in, if you like, and who hasn't. Yes. And unless we use these legal tests that are designed to enable judges at what we call half-time or juries at the close of the case to make those assessments within that safe legal framework, then convictions are not safe. It's as simple as that. We're not directing juries to bring in safe answers. If they've not considered knowledge or they've not considered whether there could be an overwhelming supervening act putting themselves in the shoes of the defendant, or they've not considered whether other realistic possibilities can be rebutted, those tests that we use, and you can use more ordinary language than that, but as lawyers, if we're not requiring judges and or juries to reach their decisions within that legal framework, then you can confidently say that more cases post-Jogi have resulted in unsafe convictions and the system is still not working properly, even though we cured the law on intention, on state of mind. There are all these other problems because of the over-enthusiasm to convict people who've not done very much at all. So it just takes a very, very long time for errors to correct themselves, I think.
Yes, no, it does. Now, let's deal with drill music, because I'm really interested in its use. I've got a couple of cases involving gangs and music-related evidence. What's going on there? Because often it's used as a guilt by association and using the joint enterprise principle there. So, and I noticed recently you were involved in a case where there was an acquittal after about 7 weeks. I forget the name now when I was doing the research. What's going on with gang and music-related evidence?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's a whole podcast in itself, and I'd encourage everyone to look at the work of Abinar Osuwu-Bempa at LSE. She is doing some really groundbreaking research on the admissibility of drill music, and she was very, very helpful in our recent case, which was an interesting one because in the end we agreed to some gang evidence being admissible because our point was that our client was being exploited by said gang, so it became relevant. So there are two things to think about, it seems to me, and rather than do a whole podcast on gang and drill music, I think it's worth thinking about it in this way. First of all, we don't have guilt by association, and there is a real danger that in labeling groups of people as gangs, even people who wear the same hats or have the same tattoos or have the similar affiliations are not necessarily a real gang whose purpose is criminality. So cases should not involve the language of gang at all unless you can properly prove that it is a group of people who work together to engage in the sorts of criminality that the persons are accused of. So if they are a gang who engage in what we call, for example, county lines drug dealing, or are engaged in criminality in terms of shooting people, the Krays, for example, is a historic example of where we know that they were engaging in the sort of criminality that was violence to get people to pay rent and money for a protection racket. So unless you can show that a gang is actually has that, a group has the purpose of criminality, which is the definition of a gang, then there shouldn't be reference to gangs at all. And young people hang around in groups all the time. They worship and have affiliations without actually being gang members or involved in that gang activity. And there are a lot of cases now where there is serious concern that the language of gang has really been used to convict people for guilt by association, and that we haven't drawn the distinction between relevant gang evidence and not relevant gang evidence in the way that I'm trying to describe. And add to that, we start using the music they listen to, you can start to see how people are at risk of being criminalized for their culture and associations, and not for what they may or may not have done, not for the actual crime, but for all this other stuff that is admitted as alleged bad character. So they're convicted on, if you like, their reputation rather than any evidence of crime. And I think particularly in the context of music, it is used very, very badly in criminal trials. Okay, rappers sing about shooting and drug dealing and having money, but that's the genre. And the example I like to use is Tom Jones sings a song called Delilah, in which he is singing about domestic violence. He kills Delilah because she's seeing someone else. He sees the light at her window and he's jealous, and she comes to the door and he stabs her to death. He sees the knife in his hand and she was no more. And I don't suppose for a moment there's been a criminal trial in England and Wales where Tom Jones has been used. You know, he killed his wife and he was listening to Tom Jones, so he must be guilty. And that, I think,
or inciting violence.
Yeah, you know, that it's a shame, because Delilah's wonderful to listen to until you know the lyrics, and I find it now very uncomfortable. But it's a really good example of where we go wrong with drill music. You know, the case that I did very recently, one of the issues was possession of a balaclava as a hat. And for me, that's a fashion item. Pussy Riot wear balaclavas. You know, balaclavas aren't necessarily used for criminal activity. Now, they might be. We have to have evidence that this person is wearing the balaclava for a particular reason, not just that they choose to wear a balaclava to be in a video, which they would do if the police are then going to use their video in criminal proceedings. So there's a sort of circularity to it that makes no sense at all. And I think we should get over ourselves in using music in criminal cases. It just really demonstrates that most lawyers don't know what's going on in the real world. And it can be very dangerous to convict people on really what we would call in court prejudice, you know, bad reputation rather than relevant evidence. And I'm very, very uncomfortable with the use of music. And I think that's being understood a bit more. My case was a bit different because we did agree some gang evidence was admissible, but it was relevant because we were raising issues of exploitation. So you can see where the word relevance does some hard work here. Yes. And I don't think it's being put to the task enough in cases where music is being used. So look, it's a test for criminal courts, because those gangs engaged in criminality, we definitely want to get them before the courts and have them properly tried in a fair trial process.
Yeah.
Those who are listening to that type of music and engaging in it, particularly young people who really have no proper connection with gang activity, shouldn't be anywhere near a court. And somehow we need to sort that out. And that's our responsibility in charging decisions, prosecutorial conduct, and of course, raising a robust defence, and for judges to be brave enough to intervene and say, well, hang on a minute, here's the law, this is how the law works, this case has to stop, or this case goes to a jury. So that's our responsibility, it seems to me. And always in the context of complicity, our system creates problems for itself, which can, of course, make the system fall into disrepute. And you do want to be able to say you have the best criminal justice system in the world. And I certainly can't say that about the English criminal justice system in the context of complicity, which is why I like to chat to you about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Felicity, we're concluding on this particular episode now. And so I want to ask you, I suppose, a concluding question, so to speak, about maybe some of the dangers of expansive liability, maybe errors by lawyers like me, maybe, I know you don't blame judges, there's no blame culture here, but where some of the issues can appear to be politics disguised as policy. And I always say on this podcast, don't I, that we take out the emotions involved in the law or the legal cases we're discussing here. And I have no interest in politics at all. I'm a lawyer by trade, and there we are. But do you see sometimes some of these issues looking political rather than policy? And what are the dangers of expansive liability, I suppose?
Yeah, look, sometimes I'm just really tired that there have been all these examples of where the legal profession or jurists as a whole, lawyers, judges, don't work to make it safe. That we shouldn't just say, well, we'll sort that out in the Court of Appeal, or, well, this is the way we've always done it, or didn't that bloke give a good speech? It's not about people's reputation. It's about people's liberty. And I think sometimes I just get really tired that we haven't worked hard enough to make sure that we haven't expanded liability, that we don't make errors, that we do avoid at least the appearance of politics instead of policy. Of course, there's a lot of policy behind criminal justice. And I think it comes back to this idea that sometimes it's easy to follow a particular route. It feels easier to prosecute on this basis or easier to defend by mounting this argument. And it should never be easy to take someone's liberty away. It should be a formal process that acts on behalf of victims of crime to ensure that their cases, that they have access to justice, that there's no impunity for perpetrators, but at the same time that we recognise that it's a system that can go wrong, that it can miscarry, that justice can miscarry in both evidence and law. And we as professionals have to work hard to make sure, firstly, that doesn't happen, but we're all human and so mistakes are made. And secondly, where it does, for example, we create a form of liability that over-criminalises secondary parties, we fix it, which the judges did in Jogi, but we then make sure that all the fallout from that is dealt with in a way that gives us confidence in our justice system. And it's why I think I can come right back to the beginning. It's why I always say to people, look, if you want to argue with me, if you want to tell me I'm wrong, go away and read the 500 years of history that I read, where you could see the threads of policy coming through. You could see how the law changed when we needed to deal with, you know, the working class who were rioting, or the Irish, or the black people. There's a real feel of, let's create something to see what we can do. And in the modern world, we do that for knife crime. Let's see what we can do about knife crime as though it's something new. And it is a serious issue, but it's not an issue that requires reform of our whole justice system when we recognise that knife crime is a crime. We just want to make sure we identify those people who are committing a particular crime and deal with it. And we've got social structures that try and ensure that knife crime doesn't occur at all. And it's not new. We can watch Peaky Blinders and know that knife crime's been a problem for a very long time. Those things we feel emotionally about shouldn't cause our legal system to fail in its protection of accused persons to ensure that they are not wrongly convicted. And I think that's how I think about it. Like you, I'm not a politician. I'm sure a politician could put it more eloquently than I, but that is really the problem, that we've had centuries of a system that relies on a good speech. And what we've really got to think about is how the rules work to identify criminal responsibility or not to convict people who've either not involved themselves or where there is not sufficient evidence that we have that foundation, solid foundation, that the legal system is trustworthy for both victims and defendants.
Absolutely, absolutely. Wow. Well, as I digest that, I realise that I omitted to ask you one last question, so perhaps you'll indulge me. It's only a quick one. I've got a particular interest in vulnerable people, vulnerable witnesses, vulnerable defendants, and those with neurodivergent conditions. So I'm really interested in your recent brilliant appointment to University of Salford up here in Manchester. And I think you're going to be doing some work on autism with them. I just wondered if you could share what you'll be doing there briefly, or whether you're permitted to at all.
Yeah, look, I've worked particularly with Andrew Rowland for 7 years now. And Clara Leely is the autism expert at Salford. Andrew's in the Health and Society Centre that I'm connected to now as an honorary professor. So I have, and I've worked at the Advocates Gateway on the committee and as an ambassador for a very long time, producing toolkits for advocacy with vulnerable people. So it's been something that I'm really interested in. And very recently, I published a two-part article in the New Law Journal on trauma-informed courts. I think the way in which we deal with vulnerable people needs to be looked at holistically, if you like, for anybody who's vulnerable, who's coming to court, whether that's a lawyer, a defendant, a witness. Our understanding of trauma is so much better that we need to adjust the way our system functions. And that's a big ask. How are we going to make that work? So, look, again, I think that's a whole other podcast. But the work that I'm doing there, the easiest answer to your question is in the June edition, June 21 edition of Libertas Lens, which is on the website of my Libertas Chambers in London.
Yeah.
Professor Andrew Rowland, Dr. Clara Leely and I give an overview, actually relevant to the law on complicity that we're talking about today, on autism and the criminal law. So I'd encourage everyone to read that. And I can tell you that we are building on that with a more formal briefing note and some research projects. And obviously read the work of Clara Leely in particular. The other place to look is at the Alex Henry petition, because we've petitioned for mercy on his behalf to the Secretary of State. And that's been bounced off to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. That's freely available online, and that gives you a whole heap of research into autism and the criminal law. So the work that I'm doing is connected to at Salford is connected to how do we reform the criminal justice system to ensure that people with autism are properly understood. So I'm hoping it's going to be useful.
Fantastic. Well, it will be to many of us in this area, but I think in all the other jurisdictions also, where the issue has become more pertinent, and, you know, including employment and some of the civil courts.
Yeah.
Felicity, it's always wonderful to talk to you, particularly about the law, actually. So I think we're both sort of geeks together, legal geeks or girly swats. It's been really interesting to catch up on the law of joint enterprise. And I'm really looking forward to finding out what happens with your outstanding appeals. And I'd like to invite you back to talk to us about some of the other areas, which I'm especially interested in. But for today, thank you so much for talking on the Law and Guidance podcast with me. It's been really, really interesting.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.